are so tardy in beginning this argument. The court was, along with students from the Milwaukee and Waukesha area, celebrating Law Day today in celebrating the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. And the program ran 20 minutes longer than expected. So we're glad you stayed. So we shall begin. I'll call our third case for today, 02-1681. Laverne, is it Hazy? Hayes versus Badger Mining Corporation. Arguing for the plaintiffs is Louis L. Plotkin, who will be introduced by Wisconsin attorney Ronald L. Lampe. Counsel?
May it please the court, counsel for the respondents. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Plotkin and his partner, Rodney Vincent. The three of us tried this case together in Oshkosh, and Mr. Plotkin will make the argument. Thank you.
He's a member of what bar, counsel?
Louisiana Bar.
Louisiana, you're in person of good standing in the Louisiana Bar?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, then you are admitted pro hac vici for purposes of this argument, counsel.
Thank you.
We're delighted to have you here.
It's a beautiful building, and thank you for allowing me to present the oral argument. Let me begin by saying that when we started the trial in this case, we went forward under Section 402A, the Green decision, and the standard civil jury instructions for strict liability. It wasn't until after we rested that the restatement third of torts emerged as an issue and was used as the basis to dismiss our strict products liability claim. That decision by Judge Schmidt at the circuit court level was, of course, affirmed, and it's our position that the adoption, if they had the power to do that, of the restatement third, Section 5, was legal error and in contradiction of the Green case. Not being familiar with the question and answer format, I will turn now to the Section 5 issues, as I call them. Let me begin just by briefly saying that Section 5 is a component part rule. It applies when a plaintiff is injured by a finished product into which a component part was integrated. The Wisconsin Supreme Court, 30 years...
If I can stop you at this point, and I know it's very early in your argument to stop.
No problem.
But I'd like to clarify something, and it's something that's troubling me.
Okay.
Are you making an argument in regard to the duty to warn, or are you strictly making an argument related to strict liability and tort? There seems to be some real confusion in the briefs.
There is, and I apologize for that. My reply brief probably wasn't as good or as clear as it could have been. We are only going on a products-only claim. We are not asserting a failure-to-warn claim in any way. When I raised that issue, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so we really should zero in, as far as you're concerned, on 402A and on whether or not Section 5 of the Restatement Third should or should not be the law in Wisconsin?
Yes, sir. That is our position.
Thank you.
If I might turn back for a minute, it's the plaintiff's position that there is an incompatibility between the Green case on the one hand and Restatement Third, Section 5 on the other. The Green case, even to a Louisiana lawyer, is very clear that the consumer contemplation test is the exclusive test for products liability in Wisconsin. That includes all products, component part, as was set forth in the City of Franklin case, finished products, and so forth. And that's a good rule because consistency and predictability of verdicts where one standard applies is appropriate. The other part, of course, is in the Green case, this court rejected Section 2B of the Restatement Third of Torts as being fundamentally at odds with Wisconsin law. Section 5 uses Section 2B to determine whether a component part is defective. So, for example, if this court were to affirm and adopt Restatement Third, the next case that will come up will be a different kind of component part case. A switch is incorporated into a machine. A conveyor belt is put into a bigger piece of equipment. And the issue there will be, under Section 2B, is that product defective, defectively designed? This court has said Section 2B is incompatible with the law. Now, obviously, this court has the power to do whatever it wants to do. But it's our position that in Green, when 2B was said it's not the law, Section 5 cannot peacefully coexist with that ruling.
Well, counsel, just I'm familiar with the Green case, and also I just wanted to talk about the Glassy case just for a moment.
About the what case?
Glassy, G-L-A-S-S-Y.
Yes, sir. Right. Yes, sir.
Only because the process here, and I just want to have this correct, the process here is that sand was delivered by Badger Mining, and this was silica sand. And then that, and that the sand was then processed by Nina, which it underwent a transformation. So in other words, a substantial change took place. In other words, the sand as delivered was not, and maybe you're going to, was in a harmful capacity as the sand when it was processed. In other words, they had to put it through this process and then it became, as I understand it, transformed into a much smaller component. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's the argument, that the sand was made respirable when it went into the foundry, but it wasn't breathable or respirable at the time it was delivered. And I'd like to address that if I could. Just
I didn't want to jump ahead, but I...
No, I knew this was an important issue for the court, and if I could address that now. It's our position that there is an issue of fact here on whether Badger's foundry sand was substantially changed. And Justice Wilcox, I would disagree with you a little bit in that we don't maintain that the sand was substantially changed, because when you wrote in Glassy, a substantial change is in the design, function, or character of the product. Here, when the sand was delivered, it was delivered in the same form and used in that form by Nina Foundry. And it was used in the intended manner to make molds to pour like the manhole covers you see on the street outside. Number two, there's no change in the character of the product. It was 100% virtually pure silica when it was delivered. And the only thing that happened to it was it went from large silica particles to small silica particles. It's the silica that causes silicosis. The issue of fact here, if I could say, they argued that the change in size alone is a substantial change in the product, which we disagree with. A jury, had this gone to the jury, they may have adopted that view.
This is going to show my, perhaps, ignorance, but
yes,
sand, as I understood the sand, was the sand, the silica sand, a breathable? Was it, in other words, you had the respirators which the employees put on. If the sand as it was delivered, the form was changed only because it was made smaller. Is that correct?
Yes. In the foundry, when the sand was delivered, it was used and mixed with other moisture-containing chemicals to pack molds so you could pour manhole covers, molten metal, into it. Where the sand gets broken down, for example, is in when it shook out. It's like a jello mold, is what I told the jury. You have a mold, you pour liquid into it, it cools, you take the mold off, and there's the jello mold. Same thing when you make a manhole cover, an anchor, whatever. So when the sand mold is destroyed, the silica particles that are respirable in size get liberated. In Mr. Hayes' job, he would grind off sand off the casting. But the other point I tried to make in the brief, in the Glassy case...
Can I just interrupt you again and clarify that? The sand, when it arrives, is not sand that is going to be breathed in by a person wearing a respirator. Is that correct?
Well, it actually is, and that's part of the interesting part of this case. Badger knew. They knew that the sand, when used in its ordinary and intended fashion, would release respirable particles. And that's a critical distinction from the Glassy case.
Well, I think the question that's being asked is, was the sand respirable when it was delivered, not after it was used, but sitting there in the bag.
When it arrives at the foundry, it's my understanding that
it's not
breathable, if you will, through the respirator.
At that time,
after there's a process that goes on, then it can be breathable through the respirator. Is that correct?
That's correct. What happens is that the sand in its foreseeable use is converted into a respirable form, and that's why on the material safety data sheets that Badger sent out, even though it's not respirable when they sell it, Badger indicates that the hazardous component is respirable silica. Now, why would they warn of that? Because they knew the sand would be transformed every time it's used in every foundry. Let me make clear, the NINA foundry did nothing special to this sand. Badger knew its sand would release respirable particles every single time it's used.
So if it's not respirable when it arrives, and yet it becomes so, isn't that a substantial change? Tell me why that isn't substantial.
The reason I don't, I mean, you may not agree with me, but our position for the jury was twofold on this point. Number one, a substantial change would be if the foundry added silica to the product and made it more dangerous than it was. They didn't do that here. The product was silica from the beginning to the end. Nothing changed that. Part two, even if there is a substantial change, the test, the fifth factor of the DIPL test, uses the word expected to reach the consumer without substantial change. And here, the expectation of the manufacturer, even assuming there is a substantial change, the expectation of the manufacturer was that the change would occur. That was its foreseeable use. And therefore, this is not like Glassy, where the court was meticulous in showing why the caps were different. You know, one cap on the tank was different from the second one. It was an unexpected change to that product, and rightfully so, the manufacturer was not held liable for an unanticipated or unexpected change. The evidence is without dispute. Badger knew that every time the sand would be used in the foundry, respirable particles would result. That is why Badger warned of the silicosis hazard.
What exactly is the defect, though?
Excuse me?
You have to have some evidence of defectiveness.
Yes.
What exactly is the defect? It's not a design defect.
It is a design defect. And if I could explain, here's our position that we wanted to argue to the jury to.
Well, tell me what the evidence is, not what you would have argued.
This is the evidence, Your Honor, that the sand, when used in its intended way, in a foundry, by an employee, my client, with a respirator on, he still got silicosis. And what was unreasonably dangerous and defective about this sand was that the particles of dust it gave off in its intended use undermined the performance of Mr. Hayes' respirator. So what was more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user here was that Badger's sand destroyed the protective capabilities of Mr. Hayes' respirator. The foundry did not know that.
How is that a defect in the sand? Isn't that a defect in the respirator?
It may be. This was a case that had multiple defective products. The respirators, the jury could find, were defective. But the sand, too, we argue, could be found defective because that fact, the fact that the sand could destroy a respirator, was more dangerous than anyone ever contemplated at the foundry.
How could it be made safer, or what is it that Badger did to make it defective and unreasonably dangerous?
The fact is that under the Green case, a product can be defective solely based on the consumer contemplation test. We think there's evidence in the record to support that. What Badger could have done, and this is what I said in my reply brief that caused confusion, a defense to an unreasonably dangerous product is for a manufacturer to argue we gave an adequate warning. We took an unsafe product and made it safe through an adequate warning. That did not happen here.
Well, you said this isn't a warnings case.
I am not claiming this is a warnings case. They argued absolute liability in their brief. And what I was trying to illustrate is that we are not making a claim for absolute liability. Why? You have the five-factor DIPL test. That's our burden to meet. And number two, the defendant, as the Green Court said, could get outside of strict liability with an adequate warning. The burden shifts to them if they want to show the product is not unreasonably dangerous through a warning. I'm not claiming a warning is defective. I'm not saying it has anything to do with this case. But the fact is that in Green, when the court said that a product can be defective solely based on the consumer contemplation test, that was for us, the applicable rule of law.
Green was a design defect case, though. Green wasn't a warnings case.
Well, I'm just simply saying that here we think that there's a defect in the sand because it's more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user, and Badger knew that. There's evidence in the record that Badger knew that high-efficiency filters, had they been used instead of the mass that Mr. Hayes used, we wouldn't have had this problem.
Right, but that, again, points to fault, points to liability on the part of the respirator
manufacturer,
not the sand company.
Well, that to me is an issue of fact for the jury. What the percentage of responsibility would have been assessed to Badger may have been 1%, may have been 2%, 5%. We'll never know because Judge Schmidt didn't allow it to go that far. Everybody in this case, including me, acknowledges that the respirators may well be found to be defective. They didn't do their job. They didn't protect Mr. Hayes. I don't want the court to be of the impression I'm solely blaming Badger. But there was credible evidence in this record that the sand was more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user in its intended use. There's no dispute to that, I think. So therefore, all we're asking for is, number one, a reversal of the adoption of the Restatement Third of Torts. Number two, I am not here to argue that Badger sand was defective. Okay? I am here to say there were competing factual arguments under Green that the sand could be found defective. And the error was to dismiss us.
I thought your experts testified that it wasn't defective and unreasonably dangerous.
No, he didn't say that, actually. If you look at day 7, page 14, the expert said that in its intended use, the sand gives rise to a silicosis hazard. Because in lung disease cases, if you leave the lung, the asbestos or the silica or the lead on the shelf, it will never cause a lung disease. If you rule that there was a substantial change and therefore 402A cannot apply or reject the expected change argument that I've alluded to earlier, Wisconsin will have no liability, no potential liability for anything that causes a lung disease. The only way you get lung disease is by inhaling something.
Well, yeah, I appreciate the argument. I was just thinking if, I'm going to change the facts a little, but if we had a taconite mine.
A what?
A taconite making of steel. And then there's some process in that steel-making process that someone was injured. I'm just trying to imagine that a sand is a rather basic raw product. I think what you're saying is silica sand has a special quality. That's different than, say, getting sand off a beach, right?
Yeah,
that's your argument.
It is. And, you know, I appreciate you helping me with my argument because one point I wanted to make is that if you look at the comment C to the restatement third, I am not saying that sand is always defective. Comment C gave an illustration of what the comment and the rule was talking about. There, sand was incorporated into cement. The cement was defective and a building, let's say, collapses. There, the sand company had no liability. That result would be the same under the City of Franklin test that this court adopted in 1973. The difference here is that the sand product made by Badger had a special use in foundries. And that is why Badger warned that its foundry sand, while not respirable when delivered, could kill a worker through silicosis. That's why they warned that. They knew the change into a respirable form would be made. So this case does not stand for the proposition that sand is always defective. No. Here, foundry sand, when used by a plaintiff with a respirator on, and that respirator in part fails because of the sand, we think under those circumstances we had a case to go to the jury. I wish I could tell you what the jury would have done. They may have booted us out. They may have ruled in our favor. We'll never know. But one other comment on the Section 402A analysis is, the intended use of the product is always an issue in these cases. And the foreseeable use and misuse of a product is an issue in strict products liability cases. Here, by simply focusing on when the product is delivered for whether it's respirable, effectively grants an absolute immunity to Badger. And that's in the context of Badger selling a product it knows can kill a human being through lung cancer and silicosis. I don't know if there are any other questions, and I'm trying to think if I have anything left to cover, but there were some amicus briefs filed. I take great exception with really one of them, which was the more political one about the asbestos boogeyman is out there. And, you know, it's something to make that kind of argument in a case like this where Mr. Hayes is undisputed has silicosis. The defendants agree. And as the Court of Appeal found, this is a devastating disease for Mr. Hayes. So I think that this was something that was inappropriate, frankly, for a case like this. There's no silicosis problem in this state. And this man has uncontested disease. He's never a smoker his whole life. So I guess I can wrap up maybe a little bit early by hitting on the following point. The restatement third should not have been adopted, not only because of Green, but because it's factually inapplicable here. Badger did not make a component part. The sand is not part of a finished product which caused harm. The casting, the metal casting, the manhole cover, which is the finished product of the foundry, did not cause Mr. Hayes' silicosis. Badger's product did. And lastly, under comment C and Section 5 of the Restatement Third, that is based on the policy grounds of a remote supplier providing sand, and the sand has multiple uses, or the raw material has multiple uses. Here, that's not true. The record is replete that Badger was not a remote supplier of foundry sand. It knew their product was specifically designed for foundry use only. Their corporate representative at trial testified that he visited personally the Neenah foundry and other foundries. Badger's salespeople routinely visited the Neenah foundry and were aware of how the product was being used. Badger's technical support people visited Neenah foundry and knew how the product was being used. And the raw material here, foundry sand, isn't used in other contexts. It is sized, grade, and blended for a specific use, foundry work. And in fact, I have the site to it if it's necessary. Badger had a product specifically designed for the Neenah foundry. That's how customized, that's how precise this product was, not to be used in other foundries.
Mr. Plotkin, let's assume for a minute that this court becomes fascinated with Restatement Third, Section 5, and feels that the comment makes a lot of sense. Do you take argument with the conclusion that Neenah here is a sophisticated user?
They're a sophisticated user in the sense of the health hazard presented by the product. But what we know they weren't sophisticated in was in the type of respirator necessary to guard against that hazard. They thought the mask Mr. Hayes was using was protecting him, but it was not. They were not sophisticated enough to know that a special respirator, one with a high-efficiency filter, was needed. So they were sophisticated about the hazard, but not about controlling or preventing the harm from that hazard.
Why should Badger be the one that provides which kind of respirator would be used? Why isn't that Neenah's obligation to be sophisticated enough to protect their employees?
Maybe they should be. But our position is that from a product's liability standpoint, the product was more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user. At trial, they can blame the foundry for not doing its job, but that doesn't relieve them of manufacturing an unreasonably dangerous product. Neenah foundry could have done a better job. For example, if a warning of a high-efficiency filter be used, maybe someone at the foundry would have noticed that. Maybe they would have corrected what they were doing wrong. You can have concurrent tortfeasors here. This case is that case. Multiple parties contributed to the harm. Neenah foundry may have. The respirators may have. But so too may have Badger. And our point simply is this, that whether it's 1%, 0, 50, The case should be remanded under the Green analysis and under Section 402A for a trial. All these issues may get sorted out at the trial level and come back up, but to dismiss us before a verdict under the restatement third, when Badger is not a remote supplier and its product does not have multiple uses, it is designed only for foundries. We feel that was legal error. And the problem is, if restatement third is adopted, you're adopting the whole thing, not the comment. You're adopting a component part rule. So the next thing may be a switch, a conveyor belt. It's not going to be sand. Us lawyers in the real world, we're not going to limit this to sand. And then there will be two standards. Component part cases will be governed by the restatement third. Finished product cases governed by Section 402A in green. And then lawyers will begin to cause chaos by arguing, what is a component part? The defense side of the bar will want to argue something is a component part to get under restatement third, which, of course, is a more conservative analysis for products liability.
I'm not sure I understand what it is you wanted Badger Mining to do. I mean, how should they have conducted themselves other than talking about
in strict liability, I'm not impugning their conduct, sir. I'm only putting their product on trial. What they could or couldn't have done, as the Green Court said, we're going to hold you liable even if you couldn't foresee the risk of harm. I am not impugning their conduct. I am not impugning their warnings. All I'm saying is that the product is on trial, on remand, I would hope. And the jury will tell us whether that product, A, was defective and unreasonably dangerous, and B, did it cause the harm in connection with this multi-tortfeasor type of scenario.
But if there's no possible way to make this sand any safer for its intended use, for the manufacturer, the processor, Badger, to make it any safer for its intended use, then you have imposed absolute liability.
No, because in Green, the court, I mean, I just would respectfectly disagree with that.
In Green, it
said that you can have an unreasonably dangerous product even if there is no alternative safer design. I mean, the Green court was very clear on that. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but my time is up.
May I ask a question?
Okay.
First, you may finish with Justice Sykes, then you may respond to Justice Bradley.
Okay. And my only point was that the lack of an alternative, safer design is not a reason to find a product or to immunize a product from strict liability.
Thank you, Justice Bradley.
I want to focus on the words of the Restatement Third, Section 5. You suggest that it's not applicable to this fact situation.
Okay.
And Section 5 indicates that there's liability for harm to persons or property caused by product into which the component is integrated.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, the product here is a mold for a manhole cover. Mm. Is that right?
The finished product for me is the manhole cover itself.
Okay.
That's what Nina's manufacturing.
Okay. Did the manhole cover cause harm to persons or property?
No, ma'am.
And that's why you're indicating that the facts here don't fall under Section 5. Is that right?
That's exactly correct.
Now, under 5, Two.
Under Section 5?
Section 5, B2.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. It says, the integration of the component part causes the product to be defective. And you're not asserting that the manhole cover product which they're producing is defective, and you're not asserting that it, as the threshold requirement indicates, that it caused harm to persons or property.
That's right. Section 5, by its title, is a component part rule. And Badger Sand was not a component part of anything. It is what caused Mr. Hayes' silicosis. Nothing else did. So even on the facts of the case, and the Gray case, of course, alluded to this, the recent Supreme Court of Minnesota case also concluded that Badger's sand was not a component part and that it was the sand itself that caused Mr. Gray's silicosis. Same is true here. I know my time is expired, so.
Had the Badger Mining Corporation not done anything with the sand but just lay it down? They do something with the sand.
Yeah, they process and refine. The natural occurring substance here is sandstone buried in the earth.
Right, but
They wash it and grate it, correct? Things like that.
Yeah, but
smashed it.
Yeah.
They made it into smaller particles.
They size it down. That's correct. They have big sifting machines where they size it down to a small size for use in foundries.
All right. Now, what is it that causes this product, this sand, to be harmful?
What causes it to...
It has silica in it, but when it's delivered to the foundry, is it safe?
When it's delivered to the foundry, it's not respirable, and it is safe. The problem is that in its intended use, Badger understands that if that is a substantial change, Badger understands it's going to happen every single time the product is used. So even if there is a substantial change, this is a unique case, unlike Lassie, where the substantial change is expected by the manufacturer, and therefore, like a foreseeable use or misuse case, should be held liable under Section 402. This is not where the foundry did something wrong with the sand. They used it exactly like Badger wanted them to.
So Badger delivers a, quote, safe product, knowing that it is going to be used in some manner that is going to make it potentially unsafe.
Yes, in a foundry, they know that, yes.
And you want the deliverer, the supplier, to be held liable because they are delivering, in effect, an unsafe product, potentially unsafe.
It's unsafe in its intended use, and they know that. That's the basis of our claim, because it's more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user because it can't even be used with an approved respirator. No one contemplated that at the Neenah Foundry.
If we accept that, then the only way Badger or any other company in this business can protect itself against strict liability is to get out of this business.
That's not true. My case doesn't apply if Mr. Hayes didn't wear a respirator. My case doesn't apply if Mr. Hayes used a different type of respirator. My case only applies in an instance like here where the respirator used by Mr. Hayes was beaten down, if you will, or destroyed by Badger's product. So in Mr. Hayes's case, because a defect is a case-by-case analysis, in this case, the product was defective. I'm not saying Badger's product is defective everywhere, but for Mr. Hayes, it was.
Well, why isn't this a notice case when I gather that somewhere along the line, the respirator used was recommended, but then turned out it wasn't. They changed the recommendation, right?
Are you talking about Badger's recommendation?
Or the government's?
This gets into the warning side of the case.
That's right, and you're not arguing that.
No, but you're right, Judge. Justice, what happened was that in 1992, the government agency that approves respirators indicated that a different kind, a high-efficiency filter respirator, should be used with sand. We're only taking the position that in Mr. Hayes's case, there was credible evidence in this record that Badger sand was more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user because it destroyed the respirator Mr. Hayes was using, and no one knew that. In another case, Badger sand may not be defective. But to adopt the restatement third of torts, which goes way beyond sand, doesn't use the word sand in the restatement third. It's a component part rule, would be error. So we would request that the reversal be entered on the adoption of the restatement third with a remand for trial to determine the Section 402A issues.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Gordon or Kathy Gordon? going to be introduced by Attorney Michael J. Cohn. Mr. Cohn.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Cohn of Meisner, Tierney, Fisher, and Nichols in Milwaukee. I've also had the great pleasure to work with out-of-state counsel. I'd like to introduce Kathy Gordon from Schwartz Campbell in Pittsburgh, who has been admitted pro hoc vice in this case and is a member in good standing of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gordon, representing Badger Mining Corporation.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, counsel. It is my pleasure to be here before you today on behalf of Badger Mining Corporation. I, along with Mr. Cohn and my partner, John Argento, tried this case 2 years ago, and I have spent a substantial amount of time in your state, and when I got on the plane to come here and arrived at the Milwaukee airport, I felt like I was coming home. So Badger Mining Corporation is a Wisconsin company headquartered in Berlin. It has been mining sand up in the Berlin area and other parts of Wisconsin for 25 years. Badger is asking this court to affirm the trial court and the Court of Appeals in dismissing plaintiff's strict liability claim arising out of exposure to Badger sand at the Neenah Foundry. This court can affirm the dismissal of plaintiff's strict liability claim on four different grounds. First, based upon the Restatement Third, Section 5, also referred to as the Raw Material Supplier Doctrine. Second, based upon the Restatement...
I just want to ask, you can, and I obviously in your brief you did, distinguish between this and the Green case because of the product itself, right? I'm talking about here we're dealing with sand, and there we were talking about latex gloves. Natural rubber.
Correct, Your Honor. The difference factually between Green and the Hayes case is that in Green we're talking about a defect in design, a product that was actually designed. A raw material like sand cannot be defectively designed. The third basis on which this court can affirm the lower court's dismissal of plaintiffs.
Second basis. Statement third was the first basis.
I apologize. I had moved on to my second, and that is based upon the Restatement Second, 402A. The third basis, and I had it here, and I crossed it out, and I've put it back in, because I, too, am confused as to whether or not this is a failure to warn claim in strict liability, the sophisticated user doctrine, which we would contend in a failure to warn case based in strict liability should, in fact, apply. And finally, based on lack of causation, which was determined by the trial court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals. The plaintiff has limited his appeal to strict liability and does not challenge the dismissal of his negligence claim, nor, I would argue, can he challenge the application of the sophisticated user doctrine, nor the facts upon which that doctrine was applied. Justice Sykes asked Mr. Plotkin, under strict liability and under this theory that the sand was defective and unreasonably dangerous in that it caused a respirator to malfunction, what can Badger do to make its sand safe? And I don't know that that question was answered, but I echo Justice Sykes' observation, and that is that if the court adopts this application of the consumer contemplation test, Badger will have absolutely no choice but to discontinue the sale of sand in Wisconsin. And the same will be true for every other industrial sand supplier, which means that all of the foundries and other industries which rely on this raw material as an ingredient in their processes will be out of business. There is no substitute for sand in the foundry processes. It is ubiquitous in the foundry industry. It has been used in the foundry industry for well over a century, and that is why a foundry like Neenah is so sophisticated, understands the hazards associated with the sand.
Counselor, can you look at Restatement 5 for me, Restatement actually 3rd, Section 5, and tell me how you think that sand is a component of the product? I have some difficulty with seeing how it's integrated into anything.
Certainly, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. It is, in fact, integrated into a system. And in this situation, it is integrated into the foundry sand system. Why that is significant and why that brings the sand within the purview of Restatement 3rd, Section 5, is because as with a component part that is integrated into a final product, when Badger supplies its sand and it is integrated into the sand handling system and the manufacturing processes in a foundry or in other industrial applications, Badger has no control over the way in which its sand is used. Mr. Plotkin is absolutely right. The sand was used as anticipated. It was not a misuse of sand, but as the writers of the Restatement Third indicate, it is not a raw material that causes the injury. It is the use to which it is put. And although we would agree with plaintiff's counsel that it was not a misuse of the sand by Neenah, we would contend that it was its mishandling of the sand, in other words, its failure to use the sand in a safe manner by monitoring the dust levels at its foundry, by failing to properly
equip. I need to interrupt you again and get you back to looking at Section 5 again.
Yes.
When we're talking about a component part there, it says a product into which the component is integrated. So what's the product if the system is what we're looking at here? Is the system the product? What's the product?
The system is the equivalent of a product.
Meaning,
the raw material is being integrated into a system.
The system is the mold, correct?
The system is the mold. The system is the sand handling equipment.
That's the end of the line for purposes of the sands.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
That manufacturing process or manufacturing system is the end of the line for purposes of
that's,
the sands.
That's the
use.
End product. That's the end use, correct.
I always smile when it's the system, because whether it's the system here or it's the system.
Do you have any cases that you can cite to us where this section has substituted a system for a product that
yes,
causes
Your Honor.
Injury?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, it is the case upon which the trial court most heavily relied. It is also the case that was cited extensively by the Court of Appeals, okay. And that was the Bergfeld case, the Northern District of Iowa applying Iowa law, in fact, applied the Restatement 3rd, Section 5.
For a process.
For a process, under facts almost identical to this case where summary judgment was filed by the sand supplier, a bulk sand supplier, to a foundry, the John Deere Foundry in Dubuque, Iowa, and the court applied the Restatement Section 5 in holding that it was reasonable for the supplier of the sand to rely upon John Deere as a sophisticated user to convey warnings to its workers. Also,
Ms. Gordon, let me ask you about Bergfeld for a minute. Did Bergfeld go to the Sixth Circuit?
Yes, it did.
Was it affirmed?
It was affirmed. The Sixth Circuit did not address the application of the Restatement 3rd, Section 5. It addressed only the sophisticated user defense.
And that's the basis upon which they were affirming?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, if I might, why we should get involved with adopting Restatement 3rd, Section 5, if you win anyway under 402A.
This Court need not adopt Section 5 of the Restatement 3rd in order for Badger to prevail. That is correct. plaintiff has still failed to meet the DIPL elements under 402A.
However, what DIPL elements do you say are not satisfied by the plaintiff?
There are four of them, Your Honor. The first is that plaintiff failed to prove that the product was in a defective condition when it left Badger's control. And you had discussed that pretty extensively with Mr. Plotkin. Further, the plaintiff failed to prove that the sand was unreasonably dangerous. Even under a consumer contemplation test, the test is twofold. And I believe that the plaintiff conveniently ignores the second aspect of the test. In order to prove that a product is defective, and I must say as an aside, I don't believe that Gray applies to this case because I believe that Gray was a design defect case, and I don't care how you dress this up. I believe that this is a failure to warn case. It was tried as a failure to warn case. It was appealed as a failure to warn case. But setting that aside and trying to respond to your question, Your Honor, even under the consumer contemplation test, the plaintiff must prove that the product was dangerous to an extent beyond that which was contemplated by the ordinary user. Badger sand was not more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user. Whether the ordinary user is considered to be Nina or the plaintiff in this case, the condition of the sand was exactly as the user contemplated it would be, and that is it was respirable. That's why he was wearing a respirator. The only product in this case, based on the plaintiff's own evidence, that was in a condition not contemplated by the end user was the respirator that he was wearing. It wasn't the sand. Secondly, under the consumer contemplation test, the plaintiff must prove that the defect arose out of the design, manufacture, or inspection of the article while it was in the control of the manufacturer. And in fact, this is a part of the consumer contemplation test and, quite frankly, a part of also the 402A test, which the plaintiff has not met, cannot meet. His own experts admitted that Badger sand, when it leaves its plant, cannot cause silicosis because the grains of sand are too large. Dr. Hamad then went further and testified that, for example, we don't all sit on the beach wearing respirators. Well, while, yes, the grade of sand that Nina wanted to receive from Badger was a specific grade and that it was of a specific size, in fact, it is no different, as the Court of Appeals recognized. It is no different than sand on the beach. It is no different than sand in a sand trap.
The process that the Chief Justice talked about, there is a processing that Badger goes through, and that's taking sandstone and then reducing that inside. But we're talking about the granule, just the granule of sand.
Correct. It's just reduced down to grains of sand like you would see in a sandbox. Obviously, if you just took the sandstone and put it on a golf course, it would be a truly different obstacle than would a sand trap. I mean, you have to reduce the sand and the sandstone and crush it down to the grain size. But
if I can get you back to DIPL for a minute.
Certainly.
You were listing for us those elements that you felt had not been satisfied by the plaintiff, and I think you gave us two. Would you give us any others that you feel were not satisfied and why?
Certainly. The third element is that the plaintiff must prove that the defect was in fact the cause of plaintiff's injuries. The quote-unquote defect that was tried in the circuit court was the absence of an adequate warning, a warning that would have told Nina Foundry that it should have issued high-efficiency filter respirators. The court concluded Badger had no duty to warn. Therefore, the absence of a warning did not render the product defective, and therefore there was not a defect in the sand that caused the plaintiff's injuries. And finally, plaintiff failed to prove that Badger sand was expected to and did reach the plaintiff without substantial change in the condition in which it was sold. And I know there's been discussion of Glassy, and I would refer the court to just one of the observations that this court made in that case, and that is that a substantial and material change, as defined by this court in Glassy, is a change in design, function, or character of product, and this is important, in a way that is material to the accident. Clearly, the change that took place when Nina put this sand to use in its foundry and broke the sand down into respirable particles was material to the plaintiff's injury. The plaintiff would not have contracted silicosis had he come in contact with Badger sand as sold by Badger. It was only after he encountered the sand in the foundry environment, after it was broken down.
Are you finished with the four?
Yes, I am.
It's your position primarily that this sand is a component part. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
In looking at the comment to 402A, it indicates that the Institute expresses no opinion as to whether 402A applies to the seller of a component part of a product to be assembled. Can you explain to me if it's your position that the sand is a component part, how you address that language set forth in the caveat before the comments to 402A?
When 402A was drafted, there was not a wealth of case law on products liability, strict products liability. It evidenced a substantial change in products liability law in that it allowed for strict liability without privity of contract. And so I believe that the writers of the restatement second, section 402A, acknowledged that there had not been a development of the law, and it was uncertain whether or not a component part that was not in and of itself defective could, in fact, whether the manufacturer of that component part could be held strictly liable. What the writers of the restatement third did in 1998 was to look at products liability law as it's developed since 402A.
I understand your answer. I don't mean to be cutting you off, but I wasn't sure where you're going to go with it, and indeed it's the stuff that you've already set forth.
Sure, so. And I'd like to further respond to the concerns that Justice Rogensack had about how do we fit this sand into this, what is called really the component part manufacturer's liability section. And there are just a couple of other comments to that section I'd like to refer the court to, which may provide some additional information and shed a little bit more light on this. If you look at comment A to section 5, it defines product components to include raw materials and bulk products. If you refer to comment C to section 5, it states that a basic raw material such as sand, it specifically names and contemplates sand, such as sand, gravel, or kerosene, cannot be defectively designed. And finally, in the notes to section 5, you'll see that the very last note in section 5 actually cites to Smith versus Walter C. Best and Goodbar versus Whitehead Brothers, both of in support of the legal principles that undergird the definition of a defect for failure to warn, which appears in Section 2C under the definition sections for the Restatement Third of Torts. Smith versus Walter C. Best and Goodbar versus Whitehead Brothers, both cases are cited in the briefs. Both cases are substantially similar to the facts in Hayes. It involves the supply of bulk sand by a remote sand supplier to a foundry, and the question of whether or not a bulk supplier is reasonable in relying on a sophisticated purchaser to communicate and warnings to the user. The question of whether or not Section 5 applies to a raw material that is not incorporated into a finished product, but rather a system. Not only did we see the Bergfeld Court, in fact, recognize that this legal principle should be applied where we're talking about the incorporation of a raw material into a system, but in addition, illustration number one, under the restatement, Section 5, explains or illustrates that a raw material or a component part that is integrated into a system where the component part or raw material itself is not unreasonably dangerous, that manufacturer should not be held liable. And the illustration goes along these lines. There was a company that manufactured chains. The chain is purchased by another company that incorporates the chain not into a final product, but into a conveyor system. The manufacturer of the conveyor system did not put a safeguard on the system, which left the chain exposed. One of the workers working alongside the conveyor system had her sleeve caught in the chain and sustained injuries. The court concludes that it is not the chain that is defective. It is not the chain that caused the injury. It was the failure on the part of the manufacturer or purchaser that incorporated that chain into the conveyor system that is to be held liable. I would be pleased to address also the sophisticated user doctrine. To the extent that this court does perceive plaintiff's strict liability claim as a claim based in failure to warn, we believe that there is support in Wisconsin law for the application of the sophisticated user doctrine to strict liability failure to warn cases. In the Court of Appeals 1981 case of Kruger versus Tappan, the Court of Appeals recognized that the seller's conduct is at issue in a strict liability failure to warn case. And despite the fact that in strict liability, considerations such as the reasonableness of conduct, a duty to warn, things of that nature are not necessarily considered, they are, in fact, in play in a failure to warn case based in strict liability. For that reason, we believe that the sophisticated user defense, which is fully supported by the record in this case, should be extended and applied to the strict liability claim, which plaintiff has appealed.
Counselor, I'm just looking at the note you referred me to about the chain at the bottom of the restatement, the first one, quality control equipment, and somehow that does seem different to me in that chain becomes part of a conveyor system of machinery. So it's really not like the sand that ends up on the ground or in the air when you shake it out of a mold. I have some difficulty with the analogy, and I will read the case when we are done here. And I have not read Bergfeld, so perhaps the reasoning there will persuade me. But so far, I'm not at all persuaded that the sand is ever incorporated into anything.
If the sand is not incorporated into the system, it simply does not become respirable. The only way in which the sand becomes respirable is when it's put to that use.
It becomes respirable because it's broken into pieces. But if you took a sledgehammer and you pounded it like heck, you'd break it into pieces. And if you had a big enough pile, you could make it respirable. So you don't really need to have it used in a foundry to line molds with.
I just have a real hard time with saying that's incorporated into a product. So, but I will read the Burkeville case and the other one you just cited.
And I think that the rationale for including sand within the context and purview of Restatement 3rd, Section 5 is because for the same reason that a component part manufacturer of an inherently safe product, and that's what we're dealing with here, sand is an inherently safe product. It can be used safely for many, many different applications. That the manufacturer of a component part that is not in and of itself defective should not even have a duty to warn a knowledgeable purchaser that incorporates that component part into a finished product.
You know, and I can understand that part of the argument. And I mean, the sand they speak of here could easily be used to make glass. Then I can see it's incorporated into the final product. The concrete, I can see that that's incorporated into a product. But sand that's simply broken down because someone has subjected it to high temperatures and then, you know, tapped it out of the molds that formerly held the metal pieces, I have a hard time with that, but I will look. Is there anything other than those two sites that you want me to look at?
The other cases that I would refer you to are those that have adopted the bulk supplier doctrine, because the principles that are encompassed in the Restatement 3rd, Section 5 are really just a summary of the bulk supplier doctrine, which has been recognized in many, many jurisdictions, and it's that bulk supplier doctrine that is oftentimes applied in strict liability cases and negligence cases involving supply of sand and the personal injury of silicosis.
Okay.
And we have cited the court to a number of those.
Okay.
It's important that – I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I can interrupt again for a minute. If we get to the sophisticated user defense, who do we focus on? Do we focus necessarily on Nina, or do we focus on Mr. Hayes in this case?
The court should focus on Nina.
Why?
Because Nina is, in fact, the purchaser of the material. And the question under Section 388, which is the doctrine in the restatement section which gives birth to the sophisticated user defense, makes a supplier of a product liable in failure to warn only if, and creates a duty to warn, only if the manufacturer does not reasonably believe that the purchaser will realize the danger of the product. We would argue that the purchaser in this case is Nina Foundry. The other reason that it's important for the court to focus on Nina Foundry as the user is because under, I believe it's 388C, and specifically comment N, which is often cited in support of the sophisticated user defense, states that a supplier may reasonably rely on an intermediary to communicate warnings. Our argument at trial in the case that we tried in the Circuit Court of Winnebago County was based upon a substantial mountain of evidence that Nina Foundry, as a purchaser of our product, knew and understood the hazards associated with that product, understood how to protect its workers, had a non-delegable duty to provide for the safety of its workers, and for that reason was a reliable conduit of warnings. We have to be able to rely, as a remote supplier, we must be able to rely on a sophisticated purchaser to communicate warnings to the ultimate end users, because we can't get to that ultimate end user. We did provide warnings. We provided warnings on bills of lading that accompanied our bulk shipments. We provided warnings on purchasing orders. We provided all kinds of warnings through material safety data sheets. But I think what happened in this case is a wonderful example of why it is not feasible for a remote supplier, and I say remote not meaning that we didn't know what the foundry was doing. I'm saying remote and that we're detached from the ultimate end user. What happened in this case was Badger provided material safety data sheets to Neenah Foundry, only for us to discover that Neenah Foundry took whatever information it wanted from the material safety data sheet and created its own. So that if you went out onto the floor at Neenah Foundry and looked at Badger's, and I put that in quotes, Badger's material safety data sheet, it wasn't there. It was some form of a printout that had some reduced amount, selected amount of information, which Neenah determined was the information that should be provided to its workers. We can't control the warnings that make their way to the ultimate user, and that's...
Go ahead. Please finish.
And that is the policy reason behind the bulk supplier or raw material supplier defense.
At the threshold, Justice Crooks asked your opposing counsel, what is it that you're claiming? And your opposing counsel says, we are not asserting a failure to warn. And it seems like so much of your argument here today is based on failure to warn theory of cause of action. Indeed, I'm going to return to Restatement 3rd, subsection 5, the follow-up on Justice Rogenczak's question, as it implicates failure, your response of failure to warn. I have some concerns that the word product is set forth in Restatement 3rd, Section 5, that the product be defective and that the product cause the harm to the persons. You define product as a system. And when Justice Rokensack asked, well, is there any authority for that, you say, well, the recent Iowa case. But that also was a duty to warn case. So do you have any authority that, you know, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, maybe the plaintiff is sub silentio pursuing a duty to warn, even though they're protesting it here. But on the theory that they are asserting here, do you have any authority to cite that a system is the product? Because the Bergfeld case is a duty to warn case.
Well, there are, as I had stated earlier, even under the consumer contemplation test and under Section 402A, the plaintiff's strict liability claim fails.
Yeah,
Speaking specifically to the Restatement 3rd, Section 5.
Yeah, that's where I want to stay, okay. Section 5 of Restatement 3rd, because 402A and other things pose other issues, but I was focusing, as Justice Rogenczak was, on the words of Section 5, and you said system is product, and so on. Any other authority on the theory that they are, that the plaintiff is suggesting it's asserting here for that premise?
My opinion is that the reason that there is a dearth of cases that address the liability of a sand supplier or a raw material supplier outside the context of failure to warn is because a raw material cannot be defectively designed. The plaintiff cannot cite this court to one case in any jurisdiction in this country where sand has been found to be designed in a defective manner. They are necessarily failure to warn cases. And in my opinion, that is why, under Section 5 of the Restatement 3rd, the analysis that you see is a failure to warn analysis. I see my time is up, but I want to make sure that I've answered your question.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
The failure to warn case, you'd say, fails here because you have a sophisticated buyer.
Certainly, yes, absolutely. And there's no causation. The court found that there was no duty to warn, and therefore there was no causation.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, we really aren't going sub silentio, I promise. This is a product on trial, day 9 at page 138 Day 9 at page 138, Judge Schmidt specifically indicated that he understood we had the product on trial. So let me make that clear.
Well, how can you have a defective product, a defectively designed product of this raw material?
The way that we have that, Judge, is that our claim in this case is that the sand destroyed the respirator, and quite frankly, no one has tried to assert the kind of claim we're making here. Green doesn't require anything other than proving that the sand was more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user. We don't have to show that the sand was defectively designed. That's really not the test that the Green Court stated. The other part of this for me is...
What is the test?
The test is whether the sand is more dangerous than contemplated by the ordinary user with the common knowledge in the community. And here it was. And I'd like to repeat, we are not maintaining that sand is dangerous in every circumstance. That is not the position. Here, foundry sand, when used in its intended way, caused Mr. Hayes' respirator to malfunction. Exhibit 96 shows that. Small particles cause respirators to malfunction along with other things in a foundry. So the fact is that no one knew that fact. That was below the radar screen. So it was there was credible evidence that the product was more dangerous than people contemplated because you could get sick even though you're wearing a respirator. Let me cite some case law on the substantial change theory. I think the court has some real concerns there. The Whitehead case, Third Circuit Federal Court. Lead manufacturer supplied lead to a company. Plaintiff claimed lead disease. The defense under 402A, you can't breathe lead when it's delivered. It's an ingot form. Court said, no, that's not the issue. Respirable lead was created from your product, and the change in the size of the lead particle was not relevant. That's the Whitehead case. The Hammond case from the Supreme Court of Illinois. That goes to the question of whether the product was defective at the time it was sold. And yes, asbestos is dangerous because it has the tendency to release dust in normal use. Same concepts apply here. What really is being argued is should the Supreme Court of Wisconsin immunize a class of manufacturers from liability in tort? What other raw material supplier is going to stand before you next saying they can't be held responsible? A chemical, benzene, delivered in a bottle, is that dangerous? No. You got to use it. A cigarette, is it dangerous in your hand? No. You got to light it. Asbestos, is it dangerous in the packaging? No. It's when you use it. I think it would be a grave error to immunize manufacturers of a, quote, raw material, which this is not on this record, simply because the product was substantially changed, which it wasn't. And if it was, the change was expected by the manufacturer. And in the Glassy case, the policy reasons behind the substantial change rule, as Justice Wilcox indicated, was that, number one, it's not fair to require all customers to require to pay for changes made by some. Guess what? Here, the change is made by every customer. It's not a substantial change case like someone misuses a product. So I guess in conclusion, I know my time is running out. I want to also refer the court to comment E under section 402A. The drafters realized that unprocessed items like poisonous mushrooms that are treated in no way can be the basis of a 402A claim. And under the unusual facts and circumstances here, we believe that there is a factual argument happening before this court. My opponent says there's no substantial change. There is a substantial change. We disagree with it. Silica is silica. But if there was a substantial change, it was expected. So a jury could still hold them strictly liable. The product was in a defective condition when it was sold under Part 2, the Dipple test, because it was going to release the dust in normal use, and that dust was more dangerous than anybody contemplated. Ultimately, we want to put Badger's product on trial, and Badger will put the Neenah Foundry on trial and the respirators. That is the nature of toxic tort cases. We understand that. But to immunize a manufacturer from liability would be bad public policy, at least in our opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Plotkin, and thank you, Ms. Gordon, for your argument today on a products liability case and giving the court another chance to look at the restatement third, different section this time. That, again, we apologize for keeping you waiting. That concludes our argument in 02-1681, Hayes v. Badger Mining Corporation. The court will reconvene in the conference room at about 3:35.